you can own as our thanks. That's thiswayout.org. To sign up for our weekly emailed program information messages and or our monthly This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For our associate producer, Lucia Chappelle, and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 4NAG, Yeppoon, Queensland, WZKW, Kingsville, Ohio, KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody stay tuned.
At 2 minutes past 8 o'clock, this is WPKN at 89.5 FM in Bridgeport and WPKM at 88.7 FM in Montauk. We hope you'll stay tuned next for Counterpoint. And as always, we remind you that the previous program, This Way Out, can be heard every Monday at 7:30 p.m. Right now, we bring you the White Rose calendar. Stay tuned.
In 1942, the White Rose was a resistance group in Nazi Germany that worked to educate and organize opposition to the horrifying agenda of the Third Reich. In the spirit of the White Rose, WPKN offers a weekly political calendar in order to give voice to the struggles of marginalized peoples. Here are the current listings. On Thursday, May 4th, the World Affairs Forum and the Thompson Group present the forum's Distinguished Author Series at 6:30 p.m. in the General Ray Auditorium on the UConn-Stanford campus at the corner of Broad Street and Washington Boulevard in Stamford, Connecticut. The evening speaker will be James L. McGregor, former CEO of Dow Jones & Company in Beijing and author of 1 Billion Customers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Doing Business in China. A reception at 6 o'clock will precede the event. For information, including admission fees, please contact Ellen Clerk at 203-356-0340 or send an email to info@worldaffairsforum.org. Members of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council's Leadership Greater Bridgeport Class 17 are assisting the East Side Neighborhood Revitalization Planning Committee in coordinating an upcoming public design charrette. This is an invitation for all neighborhood stakeholders to be involved in planning the future of the East Side, and members of the community are encouraged to attend and share their visions for their neighborhood with teams of design professionals. The event will take place at Luis Munoz Marin School at 479 Helen Street in Bridgeport on Friday, May 5th from 5:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m., on Saturday, May 6th from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., and on Sunday, May 7th from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, please contact David Killeen at 203-385-4017. Environmental technologies ranging from the 1700s to the latest 21st century developments will be on display on Saturday, May 6th in 7 towns in the lower Connecticut River Valley. The noon to 5 p.m. tour will include solar hot water installations, geothermal heating and cooling, small hydropower, biodiesel fuels and cars, a green living roof, and organic gardens. For ticket information, call 860-242-4205. For tour information, call 860-693-4813, 860-693-4664, or go to www.pace-cleanenergy.org. To learn more about the Connecticut Clean Energy Fund, go to www.ctcleanenergy.com. The 11th annual Tall Ships Ball, All Jazzed Up, will be held on Saturday, May 6th from 6 p.m. to midnight at the Riverside Yacht Club on Club Road in Riverside, Connecticut. The benefit is being sponsored by Sound Waters, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to protect Long Island Sound through education programs. Funds raised will support Sound Waters' environmental education programs and will also provide for individual scholarships to Camp Sound Waters and selected after-school programs. For information, including ticket prices, or to donate auction items, contact Hillary Starks at 203-406-3314 or send an email to hstarks@soundwaters.org. For information about Soundwaters, visit their website at www.soundwaters.org. East End Women in Black began its vigil at the wharf in Sag Harbor in August 2002 to stand against violence in the Middle East and against the invasion of Iraq. Join East End Women in Black on the first Sunday of each month in Bridgehampton at the flagpole at Ocean Road and Route 27, and also on the third Sunday of each month at the Sag Harbor Wharf. Starting in May, the vigils will begin at 5 p.m. For more information, call 631-276-6544 or visit www.eewib.blogspot.com. To include your group's upcoming demonstrations, meetings, lectures, films, and boycotts in the listings of the White Rose political calendar, send information about national, regional, statewide, and local events at least 2 weeks in advance when possible to the White Rose Political Calendar, WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. The White Rose can be found on the internet at wpkn.org/white-rose. Today's calendar was produced by Suzanne Vick.
Thank you, Suzanne. And just one added addition to that list of many important events taking place in the upcoming week or two. We have the Norok Nagarote Sister City Project, a group I've been involved with for some 20 years. The group is now celebrating its 20th anniversary this coming Saturday, May 6th, with a dinner, silent auction, and public forum featuring keynote speaker Charles Kernighan, director of the National Labor Committee. And the event will be taking place at the Norwalk Community College beginning at 6:30, Saturday, May 6th. Kernighan, who will discuss the fight to end sweatshops and win workers' rights in the global economy, is best known for exposing the sweatshop labor used by Walmart, Disney, and Kathy Lee Gifford's clothing line. So again, that's this coming Saturday, Norwalk Community College, May 6th. And featured speaker is Charles Kernighan, the 20th anniversary of the Norwalk Nagarote Sister City Project. For tickets and information, call 203-846-1109. That's 203-846-1109. Counterpoint is next. Please do stay tuned. We've got a lot in store for you. Good evening and welcome to Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, here Mondays between 8 and 10 p.m., bringing you information and analysis and a whole host of issues that are not ordinarily covered by the corporate media. And tonight, we have a host of speakers and interviews that we trust will be of interest. In just a moment, we're going to be hearing a little bit of an assessment of the rearranging of the deck chairs on the good ship SSS Titanic, also known as the Bush administration. So one of the deck chairs that they've rearranged recently was Scott McClellan, the press secretary, has been replaced by Fox News' Tony Snow. So we're going to be hearing from a guy named Paul Waldman, who has done a little bit of assessment of what the window dressing change may mean or may not mean for the Bush administration as they enter their third year here in office, or their third year of their second term, or which I'm not even talking straight here. Is it the sixth year of their second term? I'm getting the language mixed up here, as is often the case. But anyway, Paul Waldman is up next. He'll be talking about Tony Snow. A little later tonight, we'll be hearing from Jason Leopold, who is a longtime journalist, and he had scoop on the story that Karl Rove was going to be called up to the grand jury, and he's now predicting that Karl Rove will be indicted. So that's a story you won't want to miss. He's been head of the pack on a lot of these Rove and Valerie Plame case-related issues, and we'll have him here in a little while to talk about all that issue. Michael Zweig, who is a labor professor at State University of New York in Stony Brook and the convener of a wonderful conference on class issues, will be here to talk a little bit about May Day, immigration, the labor movement, and labor and its involvement against this war in Iraq. And lastly, tonight we are going to be bringing you some of the sounds and interviews and talks conducted at the giant demonstration against the war in Iraq that was held in New York City this past Saturday. The organizers estimate 350,000 people or so were there to demonstrate against the war. The liberal newspaper New York Times saw fit to put a small photo and a short article on page B3. Which was the metro section. You know, it's a amazing demonstration against the war in Iraq that was held in New York City this past Saturday. The organizers estimate 350,000 people or so were there to demonstrate against the war. The liberal newspaper New York Times saw fit to put a small photo and a short article on page B3, which was the metro section. You know, it's amazing how little hundreds of thousands of people, how little they matter in terms of some of the major media in this country, which did very little in covering the outpouring of opposition to this war. But it's, you know, if you've been to any number of demonstrations over the last 30 years or 40 years, you know, that's always been the case. And unless there are some dramatic changes, will always continue to be the case. I guess we have to be our own best advocates here. And that's what we're going to do tonight, bringing you some of the speakers and interviews recorded there over the weekend, including Cindy Sheehan, Kim Gandy, the National Organization for Women, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, a whole host of people making sense about what's going on in Iraq. So that's coming up. And but right now we're going to get started with Paul Waldman.
To advance conservative goals. But what we do is we try to identify it and correct it so that those kinds of pieces of misinformation don't go as widely as they could, get stopped before they can circulate all the way through the media atmosphere, and hopefully people will learn the truth that way.
And as we begin our conversation about Tony Snow, the newly appointed White House press secretary, maybe you can give us your overview of the departure of Scott McClellan, who either resigned or was shown the door by the president and his advisors. But tell us a little bit about this changeover, what you think it means overall.
Well, I think in some sense it's largely cosmetic. You know, the press secretary is the person who is really the most visible person in the government after the president himself. And so the White House was under a lot of pressure to kind of shake things up. Obviously, they're in a terrible political situation. The president's approval ratings are down in the 30s, And they were getting a lot of pressure, especially from Republicans, to make some changes. And this often happens in a president's second term. So the changing the press secretary is one easy way to do that in a way that's extremely visible. Now, Scott McClellan was never a particularly influential figure within the administration, so moving him out doesn't really change the policies. It doesn't change the communication strategy. It's not going to change what's happening in Iraq or what's happening with gas prices or anything like that. But it will put a new face up there, and it will give people the impression that something has changed in the administration. And, you know, I can predict with a fair degree of certainty that one of the things that you'll see is that in the first few weeks anyway, there's going to be a lot of rave reviews for Tony Snow, in part just because he's going to do a better job just as a communicator than Scott McClellan did, who was always somebody who was sort of hapless, looked very uncomfortable up there in front of the cameras, and somebody who didn't get a lot of respect from the White House press corps.
He also had a track record of what seemed to be blatant lies or being a willing dupe for the White House when it came to straightening out the facts of this or that matter.
Yeah, and that's something that a new person is not going to correct. I mean, you're right that it's a couple of different things. In some cases, it's spinning out lines from the White House that are completely ridiculous and false. And there, the most visible incident that really got reporters angry was over the Valerie Plame case, when he came out in front of them and told them that he had been assured by Karl Rove and Scooter Libby that neither one of them leaked Valerie Plame's name to the press. And it turns out that both of them had. And they got very angry at that, saying that he had basically lied in their faces. Now, there are two possibilities there, one of which is that he was in on it and lied to them, the other of which is that Rove and Libby just lied to him and made him a dupe, and then he repeated it to the press. Most of the press believes that it's the second one. But either way, that doesn't get you a lot of respect. But you know, something interesting happened during those briefings over time. I think that what you saw is the reporters sort of taking their frustration out on Scott McClellan. You know, this White House is extremely secretive. They often retaliate against reporters whose work they don't like, and that made for a very tough situation for White House reporters. And so I think in the briefing they would sort of vent and take their aggression out on Scott McClellan. And since he was such sort of a hapless character, it often looked more pathetic than anything else, as they were beating him up and he had no response other than to repeat the same talking points over and over.
Now, tell us about Tony Snow. I mean, most people listening are aware that he's a Fox News commentator, a print journalist. He's got a radio show, a very well-defined conservative bent in his commentaries. From your viewpoint, where is Tony Snow at when it comes to thinking he'll either be a success or a failure at this new job as a White House press secretary?
Well, he's going to be a success in one sense, in that he is a skilled communicator in a way that Scott McClellan wasn't. He has made his living basically talking about his conservative beliefs for the past few years, as you say, on the radio and on television and in print. And he's going to be much more adept, if nothing else, at making it look like the talking points that he's delivering are something more than talking points. I think it's highly doubtful that what he tells us will be anything different from what Scott McClellan was telling us. You know, after all, the fundamentals of what this administration is going to be saying are not going to be all that different. But he's going to be saying them in a more artful fashion than McClellan did. And, you know, this is really, it's no surprise to see somebody from Fox News coming over to the White House. I mean, what you really have is kind of a seamless web of propaganda that runs between the White House and the Republican National Committee and Fox News and other conservative outlets, particularly on the talk radio. Conservative talk radio. And so, you know, the joke around town has been that this is really just more of an interdepartmental transfer for Tony Snow, and maybe that the White House owes him back pay anyway.
Yes, indeed. Are there any examples in recent history of the White House tapping a working journalist, you know, from an objective news service or, a television network in recent years?
The last one that I know of was actually in the Nixon administration, where he brought on someone who was a reporter to be his press secretary. And since then, it's been basically people who are political flacks. And, you know, but Snow is not, you know, he comes from opinion journalism. As far as I know, he was never kind of a working reporter, you know, running down stories and walking a reportorial beat. He was someone who wrote op-eds, who had a radio show and worked at Fox News, so his business was communicating his opinions. And that came after he worked as a speechwriter in the first Bush administration, and George H.W. Bush's administration. So there really isn't as much of a distance between being part of that opinion journalism and being a member of the administration. So this is something that in some ways is different. I don't think we've seen a commentator like him come into that press secretary position. But in another sense, it really makes perfect sense, because what he was doing on Fox News is not all that different from what he's going to be doing from the podium of the White House briefing room.
Exactly. Now, as I understand it, Media Matters did quite a thorough study of some of the statements that Tony Snow has made on his television program as well as in print, and really fact-checked what he said and engaged his reliability as a source.
Well, yeah, you know, if people go to our website, MediaMatters.org, they can see a number of different falsehoods that we've documented that he's offered up over the past couple of years. I wouldn't say he's the worst offender in the conservative media universe, but he certainly has said some things that were not true, and that's what we at Media Matters do, is when that happens, we document them and we correct them. I think that's often the case. It often becomes the case when you're out there spinning as furiously as you can and trying to convince people of that you're ideologically correct. I mean, of course, people on both sides do that, but everyone has an obligation to stick to the truth. As I say, you know, we've caught Snow saying a number of things that were false. Is he as terrible an offender as someone like Bill O'Reilly, who, you know, says something that we find that's false almost every day? No. But hopefully he'll be. One would hope that he would be more accurate in his new job. But I can't imagine that will be the case, given the record of this administration.
Could you give us a couple of examples of what Tony Snow has stated in his capacity as a commentator, and what's turned out to be false?
Well, just recently, for instance, he has suggested that Democrats objected to Bush's warrantless spying because they think that the government shouldn't be able to listen to al-Qaeda. Now, that's a good example of a Republican talking point that's completely and utterly false. The Democratic objections to the warrantless spying program were the fact that it was done without warrants, not that it was done, not that they were listening to al-Qaeda. This is sort of the Republican talking point, is that Democrats don't want to spy on terrorists. That's something that he's said. He's also said that, made some false allegations about Joe Wilson, for instance. That Joe Wilson had claimed that Dick Cheney was the one who sent him to Niger. You've probably heard that talking point again. It was false. Joe Wilson never said anything like that. But that was part. Snow was a participant in that effort to kind of discredit Joe Wilson. There were. If you go to our website, MediaMatters.org, you can list off a bunch of those. Things like that and sort of over-the-top statements that he's made. I don't imagine, given the track record of this administration, that what we're going to hear from him from the podium of the briefing room is going to be any more restrained.
Paul Waldman is our guest. He's a senior fellow at Media Matters, based in Washington, D.C. And, Paul, I wanted to ask you just about the general structure of the propaganda system at the White House. The Bush administration had, at least after the September 11th attacks, been quite successful in getting their message out in a very disciplined fashion. They were successful in quelling any critical questions coming from the press, by and large. But that, in recent months, has seemed to fall apart a bit. Comment, if you will, just on the White House structure for getting its message out, as well as the kind of echo chamber effect of many of the right-wing radio talk shows and the commentaries in the print media, how that all works to help the White House, or maybe in recent months has kind of fallen apart.
Well, they do this very, very well. There's a kind of a unanimity of everyone singing their particular part in a harmony that the White House wants to hear. And some of it is some very practical things. You know, when there's a new, when the Republican National Committee decides that there's a new line, a new talking point of the day, it will be faxed out to hundreds of conservative talk radio hosts that day. And then you'll hear it that night. And it's also given to members of Congress, and you'll hear them say the same thing. So you'll hear the same kind of message coming over and over from the White House, from the people in the party, from the members of Congress, from the conservative people in the media, from people in conservative interest groups. What's really extraordinary about it isn't just that they're able to coordinate all that, but that everyone sort of on the right kind of agrees that they will go along with that. That's, I think, what is different about the left. You know, there are a lot of people on the left who could be communicating the same message, but they don't. But they're not as well coordinated, and they don't bother to do it. But it seems as though when that message is kind of distributed on the right, everybody knows to get on board, and everyone repeats those same talking points. And you can see sometimes, this is something we also sometimes do at Media Matters, is we kind of track the spin, where you can see the exact same phrases, the exact same message being delivered by people up and down the Republican apparatus. And so that's something that they understand very well, is that repetition is important. That if you can repeat the same message over and over and over again, even if it's implausible or based on something that may not be true, eventually you can get people to assimilate it, and that's something they're very good at. Now, as to why they're having such problems now, well, you know, there's something that happens with the press that they really cover White Houses and political figures to a great degree based on how they're doing politically. And so when the president was riding high after 9/11, the coverage, when you read it, you would think that he was 8 feet tall and has powers of telekinesis. The incredible over-the-top praise for Bush that just came out in every article and every report. But now he's suffering politically. And when a president is suffering politically, reporters sort of feel the permission to go after him. And part of it is because everything that they're doing is through that prism of how is he doing? Is he up or is he down? And so if the president's poll numbers are good, they're going to ask the question in their stories of, you know, why are his numbers so high? And they're going to focus on all the things that he's doing right and that are going well. At this point, since his numbers are so terribly low, they're going to be asking the question, why are they so low? And so they're going to be looking for the things that are going wrong. And then you get a whole bunch of negative coverage. Now, you know, obviously this is something that is not journalism as we might like it to be practiced. I mean, they should be asking the same kinds of critical questions, whether the president's approval rating is at 32 or at 82. That really shouldn't matter, and I think that was one of the great failings of what happened before the Iraq War, is that since the president's approval ratings were so high, reporters were very reluctant to be too critical and to really ask the kinds of important questions that we wish they had asked now as we look back.
This is certainly part of a larger discussion, but what's the punishment and reward system for journalists who kind of stray from that kind of philosophy that you just talked about, where people rarely ask critical questions for a popular president but are happy to pile on when he's down in the polls?
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, you don't get a lot of rewards for sort of going off beyond where the pack is. And, you know, we've all heard the expression pack journalism. And what it means is that reporters tend to write to kind of accept the same conventional wisdom as their colleagues. They spend most of their time with other reporters talking to them, and there's a kind of a consensus view that comes out, and you don't get rewarded for going off the reservation that way. But it is unfortunate. And it's not what they would be doing if their primary goal was serving the public. And that's, I think, something that gets lost, particularly here in Washington, where, reporters are part of an establishment that includes politicians and people who work at interest groups and things like that. And sometimes they, I think, can lose the idea that the people that they're really supposed to be representing are the public, and they're supposed to be working on their behalf and asking the questions that they don't have the ability to ask, and finding out the things that members of the public don't have the ability to find out. And unfortunately, when the president is riding high, all the people within that establishment are going to be behind him to one extent or another, and it makes them more reluctant to ask those questions.
Paul, I wanted to just ask you briefly about a 60 Minutes report featuring a high-level CIA analyst who came out recently on the television program talking about some of the hard and fast evidence that the Bush administration had that weapons of mass destruction were really not a big concern leading up to the Iraq War. Obviously, they ignored that intelligence and went full speed ahead, cherry-picking the intelligence they thought made the best case for them and the war. But it seems that since that report on 60 Minutes, the press corps in the United States has virtually ignored that story. How come?
Yeah. And it really is extraordinary because this was in many ways a blockbuster. I mean, this was a CIA analyst who had some very specific information about information that was ignored by the Bush administration. Apparently, they had the person who was the Iraqi foreign minister was passing them information. And what this CIA person said was that when the administration heard about this, that they were going to be getting intelligence from this guy, everyone was very excited, including President Bush and Vice President Cheney and Condoleezza Rice, who was then the National Security Advisor. But he ended up telling them that that there were no active weapons of mass destruction programs. And this was obviously not what the administration wanted to hear, and so they just decided to ignore this Iraqi person who was basically a defector and go ahead and continue to make the same claims that they had been making, that there was this terrifying arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, and if we didn't invade Iraq, that they were going to attack us with this terrifying arsenal. And one would think, given the denials that the Bush administration has been offering, that, you know, oh, it was just the intelligence community's fault, and we were just misled, and we legitimately thought that there were all these weapons, and, you know, the administration didn't lie, they were just mistaken because somebody told them something that was wrong. Well, here you have a case where the intelligence community is telling them that there are no weapons. They have a very high-level Iraqi who is giving them misinformation, and they chose to ignore it because they had already decided to go to war. And you would think this would get a lot of attention, but it hasn't. And the only explanation that I can offer is that, you know, I've had occasion in the past when we've had these kinds of pieces of information come out, oftentimes what you'll hear from reporters is, oh, well, you know, everybody knows that already. Everybody knows that they really wanted to go to war. Well, you know, I think that everybody doesn't know. And when you get these kinds of these pieces of information that directly contradict the line from the White House and the line they've been sticking to, it's significant. And other journalists should follow it up and write more stories about it and do more investigating and ask more questions. But there doesn't seem to be a lot of appetite for that at this point in Washington, and it's really unfortunate.
Which is odd because, as we've just been talking about, when the president's low in the polls, the press seems to be a bit more aggressive. But in this particular area, they haven't been. And you can even go back to the Downing Street memos that came out of Great Britain that also told the same story about a White House that was determined to go to war regardless of the facts. The press, by and large, they ignored that story as well, and there was a kind of a groundswell of grassroots pressure for the news media to cover these documents, which really told a very different story than President Bush was telling. So it's kind of odd and disturbing that the press doesn't seem fit to actually you know, go after the story and present it to the public. And also, you might remember, listeners will remember, there was a recent poll of soldiers, U.S. soldiers serving in Iraq, and upwards of 70% thought they were in the war against Saddam Hussein because of Saddam Hussein's connection with 9/11 and his alliance with al-Qaeda, something which is clearly false, but information transmitted from the White House through our news media to the rank-and-file soldiers and the public at large who voted for Bush twice.
Well, that's the problem, really, I think, for reporters, is that these kinds of stories raise that natural question about the reporter's failure during the run-up to the war. I think we will look back on this as one of the great journalistic failures of the last who knows how many decades. They didn't ask those questions at the time. They took everything at the White House was saying at face value and passed it on, and they were partners in that deception, not only the deception about Iraq, but about Iraq having WMD, but the deception that Iraq was somehow involved in September 11th. And so when you begin to ask questions about those deceptions, you're making a critique of the press's performance, too. And I think that may account for some of their reluctance to investigate these stories too deeply and to spend too much time talking about it.
Well, Paul Wolden, before we say goodnight, maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about what they can do to put some pressure on their local and some national media outlets to cover these very important stories that they are now not covering adequately. And then, of course, how our listeners can contact your organization, Media Matters.
Well, they can do both at the same time, actually, because if you go to MediaMatters.org, our website, every day you'll find about a dozen new articles about things that we have identified in the media that need to be corrected. And on every one, we include information for how you can contact the reporters in question, the news organizations in question, and where you can let your voice be heard there. And I think people shouldn't believe that it won't make a difference. It does make a difference. News organizations do pay attention to the things that their listeners, their readers, their viewers say. And I think the best way, actually, is to start small, to start local. It may take a lot of people contacting NBC News to get them to correct something, but it may only take a few people contacting your local TV station to get them to correct something. So people should, when they see things that they're not happy with in their local newspaper, on their local radio stations, their local TV stations, call them up, write them an email, call into those radio shows, and make your voice heard, because it really can have an effect.
Well put, Paul. And so people can contact Media Matters at mediamatters.org?
That's right.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking time to talk with us. And appreciate you all the work that you're doing over there.
It's been my pleasure.
All right. Take care, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to fix that technical problem.
Tick-tock, it's time for a shock. Are you bored? It's time to get awed.
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news.
Faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
How to keep your sanity while keeping up with the war.
At ABC News, work at CNN.
To see so many people, colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration, and unconscious of the effect they're having.
Thank you, sir.
There was never a question raised in the mainstream media about why we should really be going to war, only when we were going to go to war.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Media war.
Trying to turn politics and the serious issues of our life into entertainment.
Managing the message.
Thank you, sir.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
In wartime, seeing is not always believing.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Mr. Secretary.
Secretary.
Okay, follow up on this question a little bit. I thought I answered that.
Media war.
Either with us or you're against us.
Media war.
The outcome is assured.
What about Al Jazeera in that, publishing those gruesome pictures of dead soldiers?
I think there's something that is culturally Arab about that. You know, I'm looking forward to some tapes of dead people. Osama bin Laden, dead. Saddam Hussein, dead. I'd certainly put those on Fox News.
And that's going to report for this time. News. Fair, balanced, and unafraid.
Media war.
Either with us or you're against us.
Media war.
Everybody wanted to see Ted Koppel running down the desert in a Hummer.
Based on the Humvee used by the U.S. military, it is one smooth ride. And being so high up above everyone else, everyone gets out of your way. You've got a great view of the road. But that sense of empowerment doesn't come cheap.
This is Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris here Monday evenings. And right now, we're going to go to Michael Zweig, director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life at State University of New York, Stony Brook, author of several books, including The Working Class Majority, America's Best Kept Secret. And Michael Zweig is the convener of an annual conference titled How Class Works. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
We got a bunch of things to cover, and I guess this has been a weekend and a week, starting off here on Monday, May 1st, May Day, of big protests. We had a big protest in New York City that you and I were both at against the war in Iraq and the possibility of a new war with Iran. Yesterday, on Sunday, big demonstration against the genocide taking place in Darfur, the area in Sudan. And then, of course, today, giant demonstrations all across the country for legal immigration and against some of the draconian measures that are being considered in Congress. Maybe I could just have you tell our listeners who aren't familiar with the struggle for the eight-hour day and the history of May Day, how this all came about for May Day anyway, which is the day the immigrants chose to have their big marches today, which is, from all reports I've been getting, in the hundreds of thousands all across this country, in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and on and on.
Well, certainly in New York City, it was pretty massive. I was out in Union Square just before 6 o'clock this evening, and it was just jammed with tremendous energy and enthusiasm, and it was really quite a remarkable scene. May Day has its origins as a major holiday and major mark in the labor pantheon back in 1886. Here in the United States, there was a major campaign all around the country for the eight-hour day. At the time, working people would regularly work 10 hours or 12 hours or even 14 hours a day, 5 days a week, a half a day, or even a full day also on Saturday. It was enormous workloads that people were suffering under, and there was a desire to limit the workday to 8 hours, and the idea was 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours for what you will. And the country was just swarmed with demonstrations and with marches and rallies for the eight-hour day on the 1st of May, 1886, and one of the biggest ones was in Chicago. And there was repeated demonstrations day after day and general strike. The workers were out from factories and mills everywhere. And in Chicago, on the 4th of May, there was a demonstration, and someone threw a bomb, and police officers were killed. 7 police officers were killed. No one ever found out who threw that bomb, but people were arrested. The organizers, the union and labor organizers who had been behind the campaign for the eight-hour day in Chicago, were arrested, and they were convicted of killing these police officers. Even though there was really no evidence that was adduced, they were convicted, and 4 of them were executed. And later on, the governor of Illinois, Peter Altgeld, pardoned the remaining 3. Saying that there really was no evidence. But because of the campaign and because of the arrests and because of the convictions and the execution of these workers, the 1st of May became a holiday that was celebrated all over the world in respect of working people's rights. And today, being the 1st of May, people were out celebrating working people's rights.
I saw this over the wire just a moment ago. In addition to the hundreds of thousands of people marching for immigrant rights here in this country, Mexican activists south of the border are trying to show solidarity with immigrants in the U.S. Thousands of union members rallied today to support migrants working in the states and to call for a boycott of American goods. So it's interesting. But, of course, Mexico has a long tradition of May Day holiday, whereas here in this country it's been kind of diminished to the point of most people, if you tapped them on the shoulder, wouldn't know what May Day is or the background and the history you just gave us. Instead, we have something called Labor Day, and you know, it's kind of heralding the end of the summer, right?
Well, once May Day got established, that 1st of May got established in the late 1880s, in the 1890s, I think it was Grover Cleveland who was president, decreed that Labor Day would be, or Workers' Day would be celebrated in September at the end of the summer. And we changed and became known for celebrating the dignity of labor, and that was the modern Labor Day that we have, rather than the May Day tradition, which was a celebration of the strength and power and interests of working people. So it's really quite a different holiday. Quite a different purpose, quite a different sense to it. But all around the world, May Day is celebrated by working people in massive demonstrations and outpourings of support for worker power.
And I think they named the old May Day Law Day from that.
I think
mistake.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And it's sort of interesting that we have these immigrant marches all over the country today because, of course, in 1886, the labor force was very multinational. And in Chicago, the people who were out in the streets were Hungarians and Poles and Jews and all kinds of people from all over Eastern Central Europe. And that was the working class of that time, and they were out demanding their rights and demanding a decent life. It's interesting that that campaign for the eight-hour day, marking that opening in 1886, didn't really result in an eight-hour day in the law until 1938. So I think that's something like 52 years of constant work and constant campaigns and organizing. It still took 52 years after the original May Day before the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed in 1938. That established the eight-hour day and mandatory overtime payments, time and a half for any anything beyond 40 hours a week.
Michael Zweig, as you look at the the massive mobilization of immigrants all over this country, you know, culminating in today's May Day celebration and protests, tell us a bit about your feeling about the power of these people, although certainly many of them do not have the legal papers, and of course that's the source of a lot of controversy here in this country, but where is this movement headed, do you think?
Well, I think that we have a real mark that's been made this year, starting in April, with the demonstrations that were in Los Angeles and also in Dallas and all over the country, North Carolina, Ohio, Chicago, Milwaukee, in New York earlier in April, and now this May 1st thing all over the country again. It's very plain and very clear that we have a very large and mobilized immigrant population which seeks fair and decent treatment at work and seeks fair treatment before the law. And I think it's going to be difficult for Congress to pass legislation which criminalizes these millions and millions of people and converts them into felons and converts anyone who gives them any help or service also into criminals. I think that we're seeing a social movement here that is going to have a very profound effect on the law.
Beyond just trying to stop this latest move by House Republicans to criminalize and make felons out of all those who've crossed the border illegally. Beyond that, how do you think that the immigration movement here and the immigrants' mobilization, how will that change the face of America?
Well, I think that it's going to bring out of the shadows millions of people into the light of day and express more clearly what their needs are and what contributions they make to American society in all throughout the country. And I think these immigrant workers, whether they are here with papers or not, whether they speak English yet or not, are clearly part of the American labor force, part of American society, and are a necessary part and need to be treated as, with full respect as working people. And I think that this movement is going to have an effect that will bring the country further in that direction.
And the organized labor movement has had a varying degrees of relationship with the immigration movement. It seems that the AFL-CIO and organized labor have changed their position in recent years to immigrants, trying to embrace them rather than seeing them as a threat. You want to make a comment on that?
Well, I think that that is right. From the beginning of the AFL, American Federation of Labor, as a confederation, a collection of trade unions, mainly in the skilled trades and crafts, beginning actually back in 1886, at the same time as the Haymarket events that gave us Mayday. The AFL unions have been traditionally very much focused on the interests of their own members and have been characterized by a lot of racism, a lot of sexism, and a lot of nativism and anti-immigrant feelings. And those sentiments, particularly the sentiments against immigrant labor, have been characteristic of American unions up until really just about the year 2000, just about 5 or 6 years ago, when the AFL-CIO finally figured out that immigrant labor are working people and need to be organized and need to have the same rights that every other worker has, regardless of their immigration status, because the entire working population, the entire working class of America needs those rights, and you can't defend those rights for some workers and disregard them for other workers. So in the last 5 or 6 years, the American labor movement has really turned around 180 degrees and has become pretty much a full-throated proponent of immigrant labor rights. And I think we've seen that in events like the Immigrant Freedom Ride that was organized by the unions in this country about 3 years ago, where thousands and thousands of immigrant workers from all over the country came to New York City in caravans that came all across the country and had rallies in cities everywhere they went. So that was the first real public organizing step that the labor movement took, were those freedom rides. And what we see now is a continuation of that, but driven not just by unions, but by immigrant labor organizations that are not unions, but do represent immigrant labor. For example, on Long Island, we have the Workplace Project, which is based in Hempstead in Nassau County, and represents 200,000 Latino laborers all across Long Island who need defense and need organization and mobilization for their rights as workers to get paid, for example, when they work, which a lot of contractors, a lot of restaurants, a lot of day labor employers don't pay their labor. They don't pay their workers. And these basic rights are now in the hands of immigrant labor themselves, organized. And I think we see the result of that organization all around the country in these upsurges of labor and immigrant organizing. Now jointly between unions and these immigrant labor organizations. It's a very powerful combination.
As we have this outpouring of immigrants' rights activists all over this country on May Day, the traditional workers' holiday, do you think that the mobilization of immigrants around the current issues in Congress will later on to improve the fortunes of organized labor, of labor unions who've been losing membership over the last 20, 30 years?
Well, the American labor movement is very much on the defensive and has been losing members. One impetus for them, for the unions to take an interest in immigrant workers is the obvious point that if you're going to organize workers and immigrants are the workers, those are the people you're going to be organizing, and you have to pay attention, and you have to really be internal and integrated with and supportive of immigrant labor. So I think that as we see these immigrant workers from Latin America, from China, from Eastern Europe, from Poland, out marching and out organizing as workers, it, and with the support and with the resources devoted to it by regular unions, too, that it can only help to turn the organizing campaigns around in industries where these workers are, where we find them. So I think we see, for example, the service employees in, union is doing a lot of work organizing immigrants. The restaurant workers and the hotel workers are doing a lot of work organizing immigrants. The laborers, a lot of work organizing on construction sites all over the country and here in New York as well and in Connecticut. So I think we do see a convergence here of interests and of energy, And I think that there may be in it an element of a turnaround as working people increasingly take to the streets and take to more militant and more class-wide actions to defend their interests.
Michael, we just got a couple of questions in the remaining moments we have. One has to do with split in the labor movement.
Yeah.
We had a whole large number of unions split off from the AFL-CIO this past year, and I'm wondering, do you think that will re-energize the labor movement as I think the organizers of that withdrawal of the AFL-CIO hoped it would? Or do you see that in some way weakening the labor movement, especially when we're coming to critical moments like this midterm election in November 2006?
Well, I think that the split happened at the very top. It was not anything that was felt or discussed or represented divisions at the base where workers live, work, and organize. So, for example, I'm involved in an organization called U.S. Labor Against the War. And U.S. Labor Against the War is an organization of about 125 unions and central labor councils and state federations of labor all around the country, including my own union, which is a teacher's local at the State University of New York. U.S. Labor Against the War is organizing in the labor movement against the war in Iraq, and it's on both sides of the split in the labor movement. We have a lot of active members and unions that are on the Change to Win side, SEIU and Unite Here, and we have a lot of unions on the AFL side, including a lot of AFT locals, Ask Me, communications workers. So at the base, there really is a lot of organizing that's going on that crosses those divisions. And we see that also in the immigrant organizing. There's a lot of joint work at the base, so that when we had this big anti-war march last Saturday, there was the biggest labor contingent in the history of modern social movements involved in an anti-war march. There were maybe 10 or 15,000 union members who were marching as labor, not just as part of the peace movement, and they happened to be in the union. These were people who were out as union members promoting an agenda of peace and a just foreign policy and redirection of American resources. The split at the top of the labor movement is irrelevant to those things that are going on at the base. So another thing that that I was involved with that is going on just along these lines. Last June in 2005, U.S. Labor Against the War brought six senior Iraqi labor leaders to the United States and toured these Iraqis across the country to 25 cities. That tour was sponsored, again, by people on both sides of the divide in the labor movement. And we have a film we made called Meeting Face to Face, the Iraq-U.S. Labor Solidarity Tour, which represents the work of union locals and union internationals, high level on both sides, CWA, communications workers, as well as SEIU. And people can see that work and see that joint operation of labor on both sides of the divide in this film, Meeting Face to Face. They can go to meetingfacetoface.org and check out what's going on in the labor movement with regard to peace.
Well, it's 9 o'clock, and this is WPKN at 89.5 FM in Bridgeport and WPKM at 88.7 FM in Montauk. And we're speaking with Michael Zweig here, director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life at SUNY, State University of New York at Stony Brook. And before we leave, Michael, I thought I'd ask you to tell our listeners a bit about your conference that you've been running several years in a row here.
Right, thank you. The conference is called How Class Works, and we do it every other year at Stony Brook. The point of it is to really investigate how class operates in our lives, to shape our lives, and what class means in America. We have this great triumvirate of race, class, and gender, and we've done a lot of work in the last 35 years or so, 40 years, on race and on gender, and with some very important and positive results. Class has kind of fallen by the wayside. And so this is a new field, a new area that's called working class studies, and we're trying to develop sort of the intellectual work of working class studies joined in to the day-to-day lived experience of class and the social movements of working people. And this conference, which is at Stony Brook University on Long Island, June 8 to 10, it starts on Thursday the 8th of June, it goes to Saturday the 10th, is a way of bringing together union organizers, community activists in labor issues, as well as people in the social sciences and in political science and sociology, in history, economics, and so on, and as well as literature and cultural studies, to look into and to have a conversation about class in America. And, of course, people are invited to come. You can check out the whole schedule and see what's going on, see day-to-day what the program is at the website for our Center for Study of Working Class Life. And that website is www.workingclass.sunysb.edu. So if you go to the conference page, if you go to that workingclass.sunysb.edu and go to the conference pages, you'll see the How Class Works 2006 schedule and registration and all the other information, how to get to the campus and so on.
No, it's a great conference. I went one year, and I believe the president of COSATU, the South African labor union,
yeah,
very powerful labor union, was there. He gave a very inspiring speech, and I hope to attend again. But, in fact, you put How Class Works into a search engine, you're liable to find it pretty easy, too.
Yeah, if you put the How Class Works conference or How Class Works 2006 or Working Class Studies and our center will come up, you go to the conference page and there it will be.
All right, Michael, it's great of you to spend some time with us tonight, and we'll have you back again soon to talk more about maybe the conference again, closer to the date. And again, that's June 8th through the 10th, right?
Right, at SUNY Stony Brook on Long Island.
Okay, well, Michael, thank you again for being here, and just to let our listeners know, the two books that have you written, The Working Class, Majority America's Best Kept Secret, and you edited the book, What's Class Got to Do With It? That's the more recent book, right?
That's right. And then there's that Meeting Face-to-Face film.
The film that
as
you
well,
mentioned as
that,
well.
It's 27 minutes, a documentary about that Iraq labor tour that I would suggest people to look at to see what the labor movement is up to in Iraq and in the United States as well on these questions of war and peace.
All right. Well, thanks. There's so many changes and a lot of hope in the air. So I guess we've all got our work cut out for us. But it is a moment of hope, I think.
I think there's something going on.
Yeah, it seems to be.
Something good happening here.
All right, Michael. Take care.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Michael. Okay. Good night. Michael Zweig, Director of the Center for Study of Working Class Life at State University of New York at Stony Brook, right across Long Island Sound from us here in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And many of our listeners are well aware of his program out in the Montauk area and around Long Island, that we have a new transmitter out there. We may be reaching some new people who haven't heard about Michael before, which would be a good thing. We're going to take a musical break, and we'll be right back to get an update of what's going on with the investigation of the leaking of the identity of Valerie Plame, affecting Karl Rove, President Bush, and Vice President Cheney. We'll be on the air in a moment with Jason Leopold. Do stay tuned.
Comes to blows, and everybody wants to know, whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? riding high, second world standing by, third world under fire, funny how we all conspire. We don't know cause we can't see how such a way could come to be. Riding on a spinning wheel, soon enough will be revealed. Whose world is this? Whose world is this? Whose world is this? What kind of world would our children receive? After all is said and done, what kind of creed have we come to believe that they may never receive one?
Music of Jim Page here on Counterpoint. My name is Scott Harris, and we continue the program right now with our guest on the line from California, Jason Leopold, former Los Angeles bureau chief of Dow Jones Newswire and a widely published journalist. Leopold is the author of the new book titled News Junkie, published by Process Books. Thanks for joining us tonight, Jason.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
I've been struck by articles I get in my email box, at least once a week from you. You have been way out front in predicting the course of the investigation by Patrick Fitzgerald into the Valerie Plame leak case,
yeah.
Predicting that Karl Rove was going to be testifying before the grand jury a week or so ago, long before that hit, the other major media. And Just the other day, I guess a couple of days ago, you wrote that Fitzgerald will be seeking an indictment of Karl Rove.
Yes.
I wonder if you would just sort of give us a little bit of the background here, and I think we'll assess the importance of this indictment if it does come to pass. But,
sure.
But maybe you can even give us a little clue as to how you've got such a hot connection there inside.
Sure, I'm happy to. And in fact, I talk about this in my book in terms of, given the backstory as well as to sort of the inside world behind the scenes of investigative journalism. But particularly, I'm glad that you mentioned, a story I wrote one month ago, saying that Fitzgerald was seeking new White House indictments that would come down within a month. Paperwork would come down. That's exactly what's happening now. Now, I have been, I spent some time out in Washington, D.C., couple of years ago, and when it comes to reporting on a story like this, a reporter needs to cultivate sources and needs to charm the pants off of people in the know, schmooze the right people, grease the right palms, so to speak, and that's exactly what I did. I have to say that I feel that my personality enables people to tell me things. I have been very fortunate during my coverage of Enron to have the same type of success. And the thing with this story is I've stayed on it, and I followed it, and I would not allow myself to be spun by things coming from the White House or from defense attorneys. And that's really the key, is to is going beyond the usual source of information. I could easily go to the White House and possibly get a comment from, or no comment from, the press office. But in a story like this, one has to, a reporter needs to go well beyond the usual source of information. And that meant spending enough time and doing things to get people to talk to me. For example, just picking up the telephone and having the nerve to call somebody who is very high-level official, who's in the State Department or the National Security Council, and tracking down that individual's home phone number and then calling that person at home and then being relentless and getting that person to, trust me. And in doing so, I've been able to sort of, line up these sources, these people who are in the know, who at least can provide the backstory about what happened, and then in addition to that, what is happening now with regard to the whole leak, with regard to Karl Rove, what Karl Rove said, what he didn't say, when he was questioned, and what I have tried to do is just really, you know, provide a narrative here for readers to see, you know, what goes on behind the scenes. And that's, you know, in terms of reporting this story, I've tried to think outside the box. You know, I'm a I used to be a business reporter. And it's funny, one of the things that when I was covering Enron that I always remembered is that they, you know, they said, Jeff Skilling used to say, think outside the box. And that's what, you know, that's what I do, exactly what I've always done with, you know, in terms of investigative reporting. And I believe that is, you know, that's what keeps me ahead of publications like Newsweek, The Washington Post, and The New York Times. But with that said, it also comes with a price. And the price is that oftentimes, this last story is just a perfect example, it comes with a price of, well, who is Jason Leopold, and how dare he report something that is not being reported by mainstream media outlets? And there tends to be a backlash against the stories that I report. And I also discuss that in my book, and how that actually, you know, how that affects me. And this is just a, you know, a live, real, you know, in real time right now example of what's happening. I reported that, you know, Karl Rove is, quote unquote, a target of the investigation, that he has been, that the special prosecutor has informed his attorney that there's enough evidence to link Karl Rove to a crime. His attorney denies it, and that's fine, but his attorney has also become part of the investigation. He's a witness in his own right. And you know, I'm not accusing his attorney of lying. I'm just saying I have sources that are giving me other additional information. So this is you know, right now, this is a situation where we have to see what happens. We have to see what is going to eventually unfold. And from what I have been told, what is ultimately going to come down is that Karl Rove is going to be indicted.
Now, tell us what he's going to be indicted for. I know you have a better crystal ball than I do because you're an investigative reporter, you know, kind of a dying breed in this country, and I'm very happy to talk about your book because it's, you know, it's so important for our democracy to have investigative reporters, to have an aggressive news media, and that, of course, has been the downfall of this country in the last 6 years.
I totally agree with you, and it's what interests me as a reporter. I mean, what interests me is to get to the truth and to get to the, you know, the heart of what the truth is, not to, you know, dish up what you know, what people are, you know, want everyone to hear. And in terms of what Karl Rove is going to get indicted for, of course, you know, I also want to provide the reality here. Anything can happen at the very last minute. We're talking about a high-profile criminal case, and in all types of cases like this that are, you know, that involve crimes, you know, a suspect, if you will, could very well, you know, try to make a plea deal at the last minute. And I won't, and that could happen in this case. It very well could. It's, you know, until the grand jury actually votes to indict, that's when it happens. But at this point, with Karl Rove not trying to get a plea deal, what we have is perjury and lying to FBI investigators. There's a possibility, it's very likely that he will also be indicted for obstruction of justice. But the two counts that he no doubt is alleged to have committed these crimes or include perjury and lying to FBI investigators. When he was first questioned about the case in October 2003, specifically how he found out about Valerie Plame Wilson, the covert CIA operative, and whether he shared that information with people in the media. Now, Karl Rove testified that he only shared information about Valerie Plame after he read about her in a newspaper report. Well, evidence has surfaced that, in fact, that is not the case. He was a source for Time magazine reporter Matt Cooper. And in addition to that, there have been emails, specifically an email that Karl Rove had sent to then-Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley shortly after his conversation with this Time magazine reporter, basically giving him an update on what they spoke about. And what they spoke about was Valerie Plame's husband, who at the time was a very vocal critic of the administration's pre-war Iraq intelligence. His name is Joseph Wilson, the former ambassador, who had exposed the administration's use of Niger intelligence, which purportedly showed that Iraq was seeking uranium there. And Joe Wilson had actually, behind the scenes at the time, said there's no truth to this. This is an out-and-out lie, because he had been the special envoy who traveled to Niger to investigate this on behalf of the CIA. So this all led to, you know, the outing of his wife, and to try to, you know, basically protect the administration's credibility at the time when you know, the country was already at war. And Karl Rove was questioned by FBI investigators, and it appears now that this was his fifth grand jury appearance last week, which is unprecedented. There is no doubt that Karl Rove is in legal jeopardy. It's right now, it's a matter of when the hammer will fall, when he will find out. And from what I understand, it could be this week. There really is not that much left to, there's really not that much left to investigate with in terms of Karl Rove. I mean, Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor, most likely would have had this issue resolved months ago. However, he was juggling many different high-profile cases at the time. Most recently, the Governor Ryan of Illinois, who was just found guilty for various crimes. And Karl Rove is in trouble, and it's directly linked to the reshuffling, reorganization at the White House, despite what the White House says. So, again, you know, we have you the people who are listening, you know, to this radio program, for example, I would imagine that they're the type of person who would, look for, read beyond the Washington Post or the New York Times. But if you do read those publications, the information that you would get is, oh, no, the reorganization at the White House has nothing to do with the CIA leak. Well, in fact, it does. Several weeks ago, Karl Rove's attorneys met with Patrick Fitzgerald and were told that Karl Rove needs to come testify again. There are some lingering questions that are out there that need to be answered, and the likelihood of Karl Rove being indicted is great. The chances are it's going to happen. And Karl Rove informed folks at the White House that this was going on, and there you have the reorganization. But it would not be beneficial for the White House to come clean on this, to actually say, sure, this is directly linked to it. What purpose would it serve them? So.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're very good. They're very good at getting a disciplined message out and changing the subject when they need to, smearing their opponents, which, of course, is what this case is all about. And, that's something you would expect them to do.
And it's fine to get that, to get their side of the story. However, you need to go beyond the White House. And if I were, as a reporter, to simply provide my readers with just that side, well, I'm not giving them the full story. Because let's face it, we deal with an administration that's incredibly secretive, that has no has no regard for disclosure, that believes they can make the laws up as they go along and do what they want to do. And it's my responsibility to go beyond what the press release says. And in doing so, you know, I believe that I have gotten to the truth. Now, it's sad that that people who I speak to don't feel comfortable enough to go on the record because they fear that, you know, they'll lose their jobs, or they will be attacked, or that their lives will be ruined. That's the sad part of it. However, I believe that, you know, I'm getting at the truth, and you know, ultimately that it will come out.
We're speaking tonight with Jason Leopolds, who's a investigative reporter. He's got a brand new book out titled News Junkie, and Jason is way ahead of the pack in terms of his coverage of the ongoing investigation by Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald into the Valerie Plame CIA leak case, and now predicting very strongly that Karl Rove is in grave jeopardy and may be indicted as soon as the end of this week. Jason, I wanted to ask you something about comments made by Karl Rove and his attorneys. Karl Rove, through his attorney, has said that he had no reason to lie and that he just forgot that he had spoken to Matthew Cooper of Time Magazine, and, you know, a lapse of memories on hundreds of calls every day. And I think he underscored it by telling the press that, you know, what reason would I have to lie knowing the truth might come out later and I'd, you know, I'd catch a charge or,
sure,
you know, be in jeopardy. But, of course, there is a reason why he would lie, a very obvious reason that many in the press haven't, you know, picked up on, as far as I'm concerned, enough. And that is the Bush administration seems to have very successfully taken off the Valerie Plame case, taken the Valerie Plame case off the table for the 2004 presidential election. And, of course, it was a narrow margin of victory that they had in the end. If Valerie Plame's case was front and center, and Louis Libby, Chief of Staff of Vice President Cheney, and Karl Rove did not lie to the special prosecutor, the Valerie Plame case may have indeed been the major issue of the 2004 presidential campaign. So, indeed, there are very strong and important reasons why these guys did lie, and they were successful. They got Bush elected to a second term.
You know, I'm going to make a little parallel here. My book, as you know, it's a memoir, and I sort of talk about my personal life and how it informed my professional life. And there's a lot of lying admitted to in my book, and it's very interesting because the whole that whole excuse, or that I don't have any reason to lie, eventually somebody would find out, well, you know, that in and of itself is a lie. The fact is that he lied, and I'm making this as a very, you know, blanket statement. He lied because he felt he could get away with it. And at the time, October 2003, when he was first questioned by FBI investigators, this came just 2.5 to 3 months after Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, her identity was revealed in a column. And at the same time, when the Washington Press Corps was writing about this, okay, and Karl Rove and Scooter Libby were, at that time, almost 3 years ago now, the two top suspects of this leak. So it was very much in his mind, and it was very much in Scooter Libby's mind. There's no way that they can claim that they forgot, because this is something that was asked to Scott McClellan on almost a daily basis for nearly a month. It was in the newspapers, and they were confronted with this. And it does not make sense, you know, that suddenly they remember one thing but not another. You know, they'll remember the, you know, declassifying the national intelligence estimate for a specific reporter, but they won't remember, you know, speaking to a reporter on background. Basically what this is that, you know, he's trying to keep his story consistent. And, you know, I'll go a step further. Last week when he testified at the grand jury, you know, my sources tell me he even testified that he still couldn't recall his conversation with Matt Cooper. You know, despite the fact that, you know, that he, that the special prosecutor held up this email, or had evidence that there was an email and that proved that he spoke to the Time magazine reporter, that suddenly Karl Rove, you know, his memory reappeared. And basically what's happening is that the special prosecutor feels that, at least what I'm told, that, you know, it was only until Matthew Cooper was, going to be either face jail time or testify about his source that Karl Rove suddenly realized he had to come clean. And this was definitely, if this were front and center at the time, if this were out there, if what we know now was happening during this time when the election was, the re-election campaign was going on, who knows what would happen right now or what would have happened. But the fact is that this was a small group. And when I say small, I mean about maybe 20 people. However, 20 very senior officials in the White House that took part in a campaign to discredit Joe Wilson, who criticized the administration and threatened to expose the administration for knowingly using fraudulent intelligence to make a case for war. And they worked together. This was a concerted effort. This was, I'm not going to say the conspiracy because that's a legal term. However, in the other way it can be used, they did conspire, to work together to discredit him. And in doing so, they leaked his wife's name. And then they sought to cover it up. And I believe that, that from what I've read from the evidence thus far that has come out in court filings, that's really what the special prosecutor is going to try and prove.
Well, as we close out here, Jason, I wanted to ask you this. It came out a couple of weeks ago that President Bush authorized the leak of the National Intelligence Estimate to discredit his critics generally for their criticisms of why the war against Iraq was initiated. There is some concern at the White House, from what I hear, that President Bush and Vice President Cheney could themselves be in jeopardy for having a hand in the campaign to discredit Joseph Wilson through the revelation of his wife's identity as a covert CIA agent.
That's absolutely correct. And, this will really... The fascinating thing about this case is that how much more information will be revealed in the months ahead. And Scooter Libby's team, defense team, has already put out the warning that they will call the vice president and the president to testify. If anything, they have made it abundantly clear that they are not going to fall on their sword, or he is not going to fall on a sword at this point, that he is going to take everyone down with him. And that, and what we're about to see, I think, will be quite revealing and explosive. It may, in fact, confirm what we've already suspected, but it will be shocking, nonetheless, to find out that the president was in the know.
What can you tell us about that legal jeopardy that Cheney and Bush may be in? A lot of the news reporting talks about the fact that... The revelation of this information might not have been ethical, to release this information simply to get back at your critics.
Sure.
But a lot of the news reporting says it wasn't illegal. How do you read it?
Well, again, it's not illegal in the sense that, a couple of things. First, the president does have the power to declassify material. But he cannot just wave a magic wand and do that. And that's the interpretation that the White House wants people to believe, that President Bush can declassify at will whenever he wants to. But this was not declassifying for a blanket declassification. This was a leak, and that's the difference. And that's the spin that the White House has put out. And in some cases has been successful because they declassified this particular document July 18th to for everyone, for you and me and all the listeners. But prior to that, it was leaked. It was leaked to Bob Woodward and Judith Miller. That wasn't declassifying. That was a leak, and it was done in order to rebut what Joe Wilson had been saying. So we're really sort of mixing two different issues here, and that's what people should really need to or at least the journalists that have been covering the story should continue to hammer away with, is that this is the fact that the president thinks he can just wave a magic wand and declassify anything he wants to is ridiculous. There's a process that needs to be, that he needs to go through. But in terms of what particularly happened in this case, this was, you know, this was a selective leak. And for a White House that frowns upon that, it's very suspicious.
Well, I guess, Jason, I want to ask you the million-dollar question. Is the Bush presidency in jeopardy from this case? And if so, why?
Well, I think that if the trial itself were not so far away, and when things happen, let's face it, by the time Libby comes to trial, and perhaps if the grand jury does in fact find Rove, votes on to indict Rove, the Bush presidency may in fact be winding down. I think that ultimately, when all the facts do come out, the history will be rewritten in terms of the Bush presidency. However, if we start learning more about this case, come next January, or at least if the court filings provide more information, this definitely will be a failed presidency. And I cannot see how this president will get any of the initiatives passed, because what will happen is that I think that people, the American people, are just going to be so fed up. And hopefully the Democrats, will have some sort of message, some sort of unified message, where they can take back one of the houses or both of the houses and really, promise to investigate this. And I think that's ultimately how it will be a failure. If we learn that, the president, what did he know and when did he know it, and if we get the answer to that question before November, look out, because this is, I do believe that the Democrats will call for an investigation, and there could possibly even be impeachment proceedings. I don't see how that they can get away with it.
All right. Well, Jason Leopold, I thank you for all your work. And if listeners are not familiar with your writings, I know that Truth Out features your articles on a regular basis. But
yeah,
Feel free to give our listeners websites where they can get a hold of your articles, which are vital to have at this moment in time.
Actually, they're all archived on truthout.org, particularly the ones on the plane leak. And all you need to do is just type in my name into the search engine there.
Okay, so truthout.org. And I think you have a website for your book as well. You want
to
give that out?
Yes, it's newsjunkiebook.com. Or, to make it simpler, jasonleopold.com.
Jasonleopold.com or newsjunkiebook.com, right?
Yes.
All right. Well, it's been great to have you on here, Jason. Thanks.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for doing all that you do. And what we can do is, arrange to have you back on here maybe post-Rove indictment, if that comes to pass.
I would very much like that.
Well, maybe we'll schedule it. We're pretty sure it'll happen.
Okay.
Or hopeful. Thanks again, Jason.
Thank you. Take care.
Good night. Jason Leopold, former Los Angeles bureau chief for Dow Jones Newswire, business writer and investigative reporter, and his newest book is titled News Junkie. We're going to take just a moment or so to get organized here, and we're going to bring you some of the speeches and some of the interviews I conducted during the day this past Saturday in New York City, where a giant march, estimated by the organizers to be 350,000 people, marched against the war in Iraq and against the possibility of a new war initiated by the Bush administration in the nation of Iran. And I'm going to first just ease into this with some of the sounds that many of you will be familiar with if you were there with us on Saturday. But there's a large contingent of military folks there. In other words, veterans of the Iraq War, Vietnam veterans, veterans for peace from World War II were also a presence at this march. And this is a very spirited bunch of guys from the Iraq Veterans Against the War, IVAW. I was quite impressed, not only with the 10 to 15,000 people that came from the labor unions, but again, the military presence there, military families against the war that came out. And one of the concerns among many people at this demonstration was the fact that the Bush administration is now rattling sabers against Iran with a threat of a bombing strike that could even include a nuclear weapon. And there's a test that's going to be taking place out in the southwest of a conventional bomb. And one woman, Ellen Frank, from East Hampton, New York, had a big concern about this test and what it may portend for a tactical nuclear weapon strike against Iran. Here she is.
Ellen Frank, East Hampton, New York. And I want to talk about the bomb divine strike. The largest bomb we've ever tested, 700 tons, to be tested in Nevada on June 2nd, 40 times bigger than any other bomb we've tested. It's considered a conventional bomb, but it's too large to be delivered anywhere. Rationale is we're testing it, and we're going to be happy with its effects, and it will be used to justify the use of nuclear warheads in Iran. And there's a virtual media cover-up about Divine Strike.
Now, if you're saying that conventional explosives will in some way justify the use of nuclear weapons in Iran?
They'll say that the bomb penetrates the earth deeply enough, but the bomb is too big to be delivered. They're going to say we need a bomb this big, but there is no conventional bomb that can deliver this kind of massive explosion, because this bomb cannot be delivered on any aircraft carriers or cannot be carried on any planes. So it will justify the use of a smaller bomb, i.e. a nuclear device.
What do you think the reaction would be here in the United States and around the world if the Bush administration did use tactical nuclear weapons against Iran's nuclear research facilities?
I would hope there would be a huge outcry against it. There is no rationale. If we knew, if the people who opposed the invasion of Iraq knew from documents in the public domain before we invaded Iraq that we were also then going to invade Iran, if we knew that and that there was just a looking for an excuse, then we're finding we're being lied to and we're being told there is now a rationale for this action. And the explanation of the rationale is all the more frightening. The median age in Iran is 25 years old. The population does not support the regime. Who would we be killing, and why would we contaminate the earth and the soil and the gene pool?
And we have here John Wilhelm, who spoke at a press conference, and we have several speakers that we'll bring you in the next little while. At a press conference held just before the march kicked off a couple of blocks north of Union Square, and it was an amazing sight, actually. Looking halfway down the march, there's a little hill somewhere down in the, you know, the east side of New York, or down Broadway, I should say. You can actually see 8, 10, 15 blocks north, and the streets were covered with people. And it took 3 hours, actually, from the beginning of the march to end up at the destination, and the tail of the march to arrive at that same destination. So it was a huge number of people. Again, 350,000 people were the estimate to have attended and participated in the march against the war in Iraq just yesterday. But the news media, the print media anyway, gave it very little coverage. New York Times Metro section page, I think it was B3, a photo and a short article, and not much in the television media, as I've heard from other people who got home in time to watch the news that night. But anyway, here's John Wilhelm, a very prominent union activist and member, president of the Unite Here, and here he's talking about union and their support for the anti-war movement.
My name is John Wilhelm. I'm president of hospitality industry of Unite Here, representing garment, clothing, and hotel workers across this country. There are more union members participating in this great action today than in any anti-war activity in this country in the last 50 years. And there's a reason for that. And the reason, as Roger just said, is that there's a direct connection between the war against the living standards and the rights of the American people and of working people and union members and the war against Iraq. Working people and their children are the victims of Iraq. They ought not be killed and wounded and maimed and crippled over there. And when we bring them back home, we ought to be taking good care of them instead of abandoning them as we did the veterans of the Vietnam War. So there are more union members here today than at any such action in the last 50 years. There is something happening in this country, something profound. We'll see it today in the streets of New York. We'll see it Monday in cities and towns all over America when immigrants and the supporters of immigrants take to the streets. There is something profound and powerful taking shape in this country, and not a minute too late.
And we go now to another participant in the crowd. This is an 83-year-old woman named Patricia Stein, I believe her name is, a veteran who served in World War II from Waterbury, Connecticut originally. She was at the march, very spirited, and she had this to say, and we'll follow it up with another comment by someone who wasn't very happy with the Democratic Party as they were marching to oppose the war yesterday. But right now, Ms. Stein.
Do you think this march today and the many before it is going to change anything in Washington and the Bush administration?
The fact that he was elected is beyond my comprehension. That we should have invaded a country. What nonsense, not nonsense, and that a man of his caliber is president of our country is too much for me. This war is killing me.
You have a sign that says Democrats, corporate whores. Just tell us a little bit about your feeling about the Democrats these days.
My feeling is, you can tell I've lost my voice, and I wouldn't have lost my voice so much had a single Democrat gotten up and called Bush a liar. And I just think that there's so much money going to Wall Street right now that essentially they're facing a very concrete reality. They're being paid to shut up. Sure, there's a couple of Democrats who have come out against the war, but they're a very Machiavellian crew, as all politicians are. They're basically saying the leadership is mum on the war. And what does that mean? Here's a voter in Ohio. They hear a very clear lie coming from the Republicans, and then they hear Democrats waffling. That's why the Democrats lost. They're paid to shut up.
What's your name? Where are you from?
Nathaniel Heidenheimer, and I'm a teacher here in New York City.
Here we go right now to Susan Sarandon, who spoke again at the press conference that preceded the march from north of Union Square down to Foley Square, about a 30-block march just yesterday in the middle of Manhattan. And this is Susan Sarandon, the actress, and she introduces Cindy Sheehan, who's very well known to, I'm sure, everybody listening tonight. Here she is, Susan Sarandon.
Now we have here with us this morning Academy Award winner Susan Sarandon, and she's coming up with the hero of all of us and of this country, head of the Gold Star family, Cindy Sheehan.
Hi. It's so great to see you all out here. You know, it's a very special day today because there's so many different organizations that are fighting for very specific changes in our country in different areas, domestic issues, labor issues. And the thing that everyone has come here to say is that none of these things can be addressed until the war is stopped, until that our kids are home, and until the money has stopped being poured into this horrible lie of a war. I'm very happy to be here walking hand in hand with all of you, and I'm very happy to be in the position to introduce the woman who's standing next to me, because, you know, she's the perfect example of somebody who started out just asking a question, just wanting to eat from that tree of knowledge, and she got kicked right out by the dad, you know. And she's an example for all of us of how empowerment starts and how important it is to take something, a loss like that, and turn it into something constructive and positive. She has opened her heart. She has opened her family, her time, and everything to try to make a personal face on this war that they would have us believe is happening somewhere in some kind of video game place. But it's not. It involves real families, real moms from across the globe with all kinds of political affiliations. And it's my great privilege to introduce the woman who's given that face to the cause, Cindy Sheehan.
Hi, I'm really proud to be here, too, because you know what? We are not the fringe. We are mainstream America. Two-thirds of this country realize that George Bush lied to us and the troops need to be coming home. He has the lowest approval ratings of any president besides the other war criminal, Richard Nixon. We are standing here to say that we are mainstream America, that we repudiate all the war crimes and crimes against humanity that are being committed by our government. We are here to say that we are not war criminals, and we are standing together to bring peace and justice to the people of Iraq. Bring our troops home, save Iraq. Bring our troops home, save America. And we are here saying that we are the true matriots of this country, that we are the ones that love our country. And to be anti-George Bush is to be pro-American. And we're standing here as not only true Americans, but true citizens of this world that want the killing of innocent human beings to stop. I had a dream this morning of my son. He was 3 years old. And he was telling me, "Let's go outside, Mom. It is so hard, and I do everything I do so there's no more Cindy Sheehans, whether Iraqi or American, that there's no more Casey Sheehans that are condemned to an early grave because of the lies and war crimes and war crimes against humanity of our regime, our fascist regime that's in power right now." And not only do we want the troops home from Iraq, we do not want the maniacs to invade Iran. We are standing here with the people of Iran to say that most of America is not on board with an invasion of your country. People tell me it would be crazy to invade Iran. Well, the people governing us are crazy. Don't put anything past them. Stop them. We have to stand together to stop them. Thank you for being here.
Cindy Sheehan, we got a chance to talk with her a little later in the day, as I know Bob Johnson did, and you might have heard if you were listening during the course of the day on Saturday, Walter Wagner. I got a chance to speak with Cindy Sheehan, among others. But here we got a chance to talk with her a little later in the day.
You're here today. You've traveled all over this country. You've been in Crawford, Texas. You, more than anyone else, has been seen in the media about opposition to this war. Strangely, there's been this kind of quiescence or a normalcy in the country generally about the war. It doesn't seem to touch everybody. in the way other wars have. Do you see a change in that? And are you hopeful that if there is a change, that that can affect a change in policy in Washington?
Well, I see a definite change. I mean, the polls are going out. You know, his poll numbers are in the toilet. The support for the war is diminishing, and people are willing to stand up for their democracy, stand up to be counted, and to raise their voices. And I definitely see a change, and I'm sure that's going to change policy, and it's going to happen a lot sooner than later.
And just in terms of what the most effective thing people can do who are opposed to this war, what can they do now?
Well, they can do what they're doing right now. Hundreds of thousands of people in New York City marching against this insanity, but also start pressuring your congressperson to do the right thing. And if they don't do the right thing, fire and put someone else in who will, because that we need people with integrity no matter what party they're in.
And that was activist Cindy Sheehan, who lost her her son, Casey Sheehan, and camped out in front of President Bush's ranch this past summer at Crawford, and of course became a real positive symbol of the anti-war movement. And this is just something that I feel is of importance to bring you tonight, and that is there is a group that has long advocated nonviolent civil disobedience out in Voluntown, Connecticut. And we got to speak with Patricia Adams, who's part of an organization that's preparing for summertime nonviolent civil disobedience against this war in Iraq, and again in the fall, I believe at the end of September. So here's Patricia Adams, who we ran into at the march.
This is the Global Call Iraq campaign calling for coordinated nonviolent civil resistance and direct action, calling for an end to the occupation of Iraq. So we have signers to the call from over 30 different countries in the world who are committing to support the organization of local events of civil resistance and direct action on these dates, August 6th and 9th, and the end of September, calling for an end to the occupation.
What do you think that in particular will accomplish that maybe hasn't been accomplished by marches like this today here
right.
in New York City?
We're hoping that more people in the mainstream take up nonviolent direct action and civil disobedience as a means of shifting the balance of power back to the hands of the people, creating more space for the variety of tactics that folks have yet to employ to try and shift the balance of power away from the warmongering and towards alternatives to alternative forms of conflict transformation.
And we're going to finish off some of our brief coverage here of the big march in New York City yesterday against the war in Iraq. Again, estimates of 350,000 or more people participated. I think it was a fairly good turnout in terms of the organizers' expectations. People are still wound up and opposed to this war. Of course, two-thirds of the American people, when polled, say they're against the war. And it seems that people are continuing to come out into the streets to oppose the war in Iraq. And to make a statement as well that they don't want to see a new war initiated with the nation of Iran. That was certainly, I think, the subtext of most of what was going on there in New York City yesterday. We're going to wind up with Daniel Ellsberg, who was known to many of you, who was leaked the Pentagon Papers during the Vietnam War era and has, since that time, been a real valiant activist opposing nuclear weapon proliferation as well as peace and justice in general. Involved himself in some of the anti-war movement during the Central America wars during the 80s, during the Reagan and Bush years. But here's Daniel Ellsberg, and he'll be followed right up by Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Bush Coalition, which is one of the sponsors, co-sponsors of this march yesterday, or I should say this past Saturday.
A lot of us remember this name from a while ago, very familiar. 35 years ago, this man revealed the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg.
Hi. Thank you. I'm Dan Ellsberg. I'm here today because I don't think George Bush is stupid. I think he's dangerous. He's endangering our security. He's endangering our Constitution. Of course, he's not alone in that. I don't think just getting rid of Don Rumsfeld, as the generals want to do, will make us a lot better off. When it comes to people with really bad judgment, this team has depth. The question is, what do we do about it? What do we do even before November to prevent an attack on Iran, which would be as great a catastrophe as the attack on Iraq, or nuclear weapons, which would be still beyond history in terms of catastrophe? Cy Hirsch tells us that the administration is filled with people and the military ranks are filled with people who are doing operational plans for the use of nuclear weapons against Iran, either initially or as that conflict escalates, as it would. I was in that position myself in the Pentagon 35 and more years ago. What should a patriotic official do when he knows that his commander-in-chief is leading the country over the cliff, is acting wrongly? I have advice for them. Cy Hirsch says a number of them are so appalled they're considering resigning. When I read that in the New Yorker, April 17th issue, I thought to myself, resigning after the attack or before it? Even before it would not make any difference. I have a better word for them, a better thing for them to do than to resign. Leak. Put out unauthorized disclosure of those criminal plans. Put out the Joint Chiefs of Staff calculations and estimates as to why that is a totally wrong position to do. Don't wait for the Joint Chiefs to do it. The officials who know that can, at the risk of their freedom, the risk of prosecution, I was facing 115 years in prison, possibly, and that was certainly worth it. They can put that out, and my word to them is, don't do what I did. Don't wait till the new war has started. Don't wait till that nuclear bomb has fallen before you go to the press and the public with what they need to know to stop it. Thank you.
There have been wars of necessity, and there are wars of choice. The Civil War, when in part of the country sought to secede from the Union and engage in treason and sedition and maintain slavery, that war had to be fought. World War II, the rise of fascism and Holocaust driven by the perverted views of Hitler, the one who was 55 million or ultimately killed, that war had to be fought. Then there are wars of choice driven by power and poor manipulation, Reagan invading Grenada, diverting attention from the Marine barracks attack in Lebanon, Bush 41 invading Panama, and Bush 43 invading and occupying and now seeking to conquer Iraq. Wars of choice. We're told that it is our obsession with democracy and democratic values that is driving our actions, in which 2,400 Americans have been killed, thousands of Iraqis have been killed, innocent civilians called collateral damage, billions of dollars have been spent, $6 billion a month and counting. For that democracy, we allowed Iraqi Americans to vote in the Iraqi election by satellite in America. On site, same day registration. 17 forms of identification with U.S. escorts at the polls. That was our passion for democracy in Iraq. But for democracy, for Katrina survivors in New Orleans, the federal government reduced the federal voting standards of pre-clearance. It shifted the burden back to the states. The Secretary of State will not allow eligible voters with the candidates. The state will not allow satellite voting. So if you can vote for democracy in Iraq from New York, why not New Orleans? In other words, the democracy for Iraqis, we spend billions. For those in New Orleans, we reject dollars. This war of choice is not just tactically wrong. It is morally wrong. We have been lied to, and we have been spied on. We've lost lives and money and honor. It's time to go another way. Our youth are killing and being killed for no good reason. We're sinking in a hole. We need a rope to pull us out. Bush wants a shovel to dig a deeper hole. We deserve leadership and to end this crisis. Rumsfeld does not and never did have the answer. Bush does not have the vision. On the U.S. hit list is Venezuela, North Korea, and Iran. We cannot declare war on the whole world. Diplomacy from strength matters. So we cannot settle for one part but two names. It's time to fight back. America's come alive. Today we march to end the war in Iraq. Tomorrow we march to end genocide in Darfur. Monday we march for a fair and just immigration policy. America's on the march again. And don't stop marching until there's hope and healing and there's new leadership in the White House. God bless you and keep hope alive. Let nothing stop you and nobody turn you around.
Jesse Jackson from Rainbow Bush Coalition winding up the press conference that preceded the big march in New York City this past Saturday. And again, as he emphasized there, People are mobilized all over this country on Darfur, on the war in Iraq, possibly the war with Iran that we're hearing from the White House. And then, of course, today, hundreds of thousands of immigrants in the streets all over the United States demonstrating for their rights and against draconian legislation pending in Congress. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next Monday evening with another edition of Counterpoint, and that'll be 8 o'clock every Monday here on WPKN in Bridgeport, WPKM in Montauk at 89.5 FM and 88.7 FM, respectively. We'll have Chris Ferriero in here in just a moment. He'll be taking you to midnight. And I'm just going to leave you with a little music to fade on out of here. It's called Follow Me to Carthage from the Mammals, a group that did a benefit concert for this radio station not too long ago. Do write to us at WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, or you can write to myself, Scott Harris, via email at betweenthelines@snet.net. Our phone number is 203-331-9756. We always like to hear your feedback. And archives of this particular program, Counterpoint, can be found at this website run by our friend Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks for listening, and Chris Ferriero's next.
Celebration is 9999. music from the Mammals from their latest CD. I don't have it in front of me, but that was coming out of Scott Harris' show. This is Chris Ferriero. You're listening to WPKN in WPKN in Bridgeport and WPKM in Montauk. And I'll be with you till 12 o'clock, helping out NASMO, and NASMO Radio will be up at midnight. And we are 100% listener supported, which if you listen to us, you know that. And if you'd like to support the station, you can go to our website, WPKN.org, and make a pledge. We are a little bit short on our most recent fund drive, and we could always use your support. So again, that's WPKN.org. You could also subscribe to our email newsletter, and every Sunday you'll receive a notification of upcoming events on the air on WPKN. And again, you can do that by going to our website, WPKN.org. And I think I identified myself, Chris Ferriero, and I'm going to start off with something from a little bit old, something from Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Oh, Lord, there's got to be a better way. Say it again. There's got to be a better way. Yeah, what is it good for?
War!
Wars come and go. What remains are only the values of culture.